some changes in the program in terms of the order of speakers. Senator Bill Nelson will be next, followed by the panel of five panelists that I will moderate, and then a representative from the Obama campaign will follow the panel before we take another short break. Florida Senator, Democratic Senator Bill Nelson was elected to the U.S. Senate in 2000, where he has earned a reputation as a voice of moderation in, as we've heard, a polarized environment, and where, together with his Republican counterpart, Senator Martinez, he serves on the Senate Committee on Aging. As Congress remains in session, Senator Nelson could not break away from Washington today, but we will hear a taped message he was very much wanted to deliver given the importance of this conference. So we'll now hear a tape from Senator Nelson.
Our health care system is certainly in the need of reform, and it needs to be done soon because 46 million Americans are uninsured, and that's just for starters. Health care costs are increasing at a rate much higher than the average American's paycheck, and our citizens are spending more money on health care than those in any other country, and in some cases with worse results. Now, you can't get anything done with all of this partisan rancor and this ideological extremism that so far has been a barrier to meaningful reforms. And that's why it's important that we have a bipartisan solution and bring the major stakeholders all together at conferences like this in search of a lasting solution. We can be sure that health care will be at the top of the agenda for the next president and the next Congress. No one party, no one interest group should be able, or I think will be able, to dictate the solution. We're all going to have to put aside our particular special interest and come together if we're going to make progress. And in that same vein of bipartisanship and consensus building, I have co-sponsored the Healthy American Act, which is a bill that would ensure every American. There are 16 senators who have now co-sponsored this bill, 8 Democrats and 8 Republicans. And it allows states or groups of state to join together to form large insurance pools. And this is key because if you can spread the health risk over millions of people instead of over just a few in, for example, a small business, then you can bring the per-person cost down. That is just utilizing the principle of insurance. Get it over as many lives as possible. Now, in these large pools of millions of people, insurance companies in the private sector would compete to offer multiple products, giving the consumer choice, and that's going to drive down the cost. And there would be strict rating rules to ensure that insurance would be available for everyone, not just for the healthy and for the young. Legislation would require all participants to take responsibility for funding their own health care, individuals, employers, the government. Every individual would have the responsibility to make sure that they and their dependents were covered. Now, those that are below the federal poverty level would receive full premium and co-payment subsidies. And those in between the poverty level of 100% and up to 400% will receive partial subsidies on a sliding scale. Middle-income Americans would receive a tax deduction for health care expenses. This bill emphasizes prevention to improve the health of Americans. In other words, you don't want to treat the problem in the emergency room when the snivels have turned into pneumonia. That's the worst possible time at the worst possible place in expense. And the access to care is going to be improved in this bill once they get sick. Now, the Congressional Budget Office estimates that the cost will break even with the savings by this legislation by the year 2014. It's worth looking at. It's worth trying to enact. Obviously, it's not going to satisfy everyone. That's the whole business of, as the good book says, come, let us reason together. And there are some that we have to be concerned about. For example, the children under CHIP and those under Medicaid. We have to make sure that they're going to receive affordable insurance of quality compared to what the others are receiving. But I think these concerns can be addressed, and I'm very pleased and humbled to be a part of this bipartisan group of senators who are trying to advance the cause of health care reform. And this is a tough subject, because you start doing this and you're stepping on some sensitive toes. Now, I want to thank the leaders of business, the leaders of unions, heads of patient advocacy organizations, doctors, healthcare providers of all types, and I want to thank elected officials from both sides of the aisle who've set aside their personal agendas to come together. And you all have come together in Orlando at this conference to find common ground. So thank you for setting aside your differences so we can have this important dialogue. I wish you well in this conference. Have a very productive meeting. Thank you.
Well, a senator who not only lived within his time limit, but gave us some time back. So we appreciate that, Senator Nelson. We'll next turn to our second panel, the focus of which is the rising tide of health care costs. Are we paying too much for what we're getting? And we will talk about that among our five panelists. And I will also turn to you, the engaged audience, with your questions and comments as we move through this hour of discussion. First, I would like to introduce our distinguished panel. Henry Aaron is a senior fellow in the Economic Study Program at Brookings, an institution he joined in 1968. Henry is a very well-known figure in health policy circles and has served in the Department of Health, Education, and Welfare, and also chaired the 1979 Advisory Council on Social Security. Welcome, Hank. Our next panelist is Dr. James Bean, who knows something about the supply side of medicine as a practicing neurosurgeon for more than 25 years, and in his current position as president of the American Association of Neurological Surgeons. He has written and spoken extensively on the issue of cost, managed care, Medicare payment policy, and medical liability reform. Welcome, Dr. Bean.
Thank you.
Our third panelist is Dr. Teresa Koenig, who is a practicing physician as well as senior vice president and chief medical officer of SumaCare, the nationally acclaimed healthcare delivery system that integrates hospitals and healthcare systems under one roof. Dr. Koenig, welcome. Our fourth panelist is Dr. James Mongan, who has extensive experience on the delivery side as president of the top-ranked Massachusetts General Hospital for many years, and in recent years CEO of Partners Healthcare in Boston, a mega system in that part of the country. In his spare time, Jim is also a professor of healthcare policy and also of social medicine at the Harvard Medical School. Welcome, Jim. And our fifth panelist is Dr. William Winkenwerder, a senior advisor for the Deloitte Center for Health Solutions, who has held many senior positions in the health field. Most recently, his government position was as Assistant Secretary of Defense for Health Affairs from 2001 to 2007, where he headed up the $40 billion military healthcare system and implemented the world's most sophisticated electric health record system. Dr. Winkenwerder, Bill,
good
welcome.
Good to see you.
Starting out, one of the things I would like to underscore is something that Reggie Hertzlinger said in the last panel, and that was that all the resources, the $2 trillion she talked about in the medical economy, at the beginning of the day and at the end of the day, really derive from households, either through taxes or through foregone wages. And I think the challenge for the system is how do you harness that consumer investment in healthcare in a way that will lead to hopefully some slowing of cost in a way that also brings value to the system. So in starting out, one of the things, another thing that Andy Stern said was he promoted the idea of some kind of a system of decision-making outside of the Congress, some Federal Reserve-like system. We'll hear Senator Daschle, who also has a proposal favoring that this afternoon. But starting out in the context of trying to constrain costs and a responsible way, does that sound like an approach that holds some promise? Moving decision-making, at least as it applies to public insurance, outside of the Congress, we've seen their performance for 43 years in Medicare and Medicaid, and it's not been real swell. But let me start with Hank and if you could address that possibility and what you think of it.
Up until now, Congress actually has done remarkably little to limit in any way what is spent on health care. Instead, they have overseen a system that is enormously fragmented and decentralized with literally thousands of separate payers. They have been loath to grant to the one large payer over whom they have real responsibility, namely Medicare, any power at all significantly to influence the overall cost of the services rendered through Medicare. So I think the road ahead, and it's going to be fraught with political controversy and difficulty, is going to be to find a way under which increased coordination among the many payers can be brought to bear to slow the growth of healthcare spending. And in that connection, I think we are going to be completely blind about which directions we should go in until we undertake as a nation, and this has to be a national effort, a significant investment in measuring the relative cost effectiveness of the various things that physicians and hospitals do today. Production of knowledge of that kind that benefits us all, but the costs of development of which are quite high, simply must be a responsibility of the nation as a whole. And that is one area where I believe Congress immediately should move ahead. Somebody made a reference to the absence of low-hanging fruit. I believe this is very low-hanging fruit. We need to establish entities in the United States, an entity in the United States, perhaps organized the way the Federal Reserve is, quasi-independent of government, supported with sufficient resources to begin a major investigation of the relative effectiveness of the $2 trillion we're spending on health care today.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Peen, I know one of the highest, perhaps the highest priority of your organization is dealing with the medical liability crisis. So you might respond in the context of, would an institution outside of the Congress, perhaps some Federal Reserve-like board or some other quasi-public institution, be able to address this issue any better than Congress has?
Well, as far as medical liability, we do think, at least in medicine, and that's one of the reasons we're here today, to keep the information alive, has a tremendous cost-increasing effect. There's a lot of debate about defensive medicine. Does it exist or not? Depending on who you read, it could be very little or up to $120 to more billion dollars a year. We believe it does because every doctor in the trench out there understands that when you make a decision, you are in the back of your mind considering that every time. So it's very real. You've got doctors who won't perform procedures anymore, won't cover call anymore because of the liability, and it's something that has to be fixed. Now, how do you fix it? Do I think an agency could do it? That's the first time I've heard that proposal referred to an agency. Our vision of it is simple medical liability reform that's been proven in states that have it. Because in states that have it, they have doctors, they come back, they practice, the costs stay down, and it works. However you administer that, effective reform in medical liability has got to be one piece of controlling the cost. Because whether it's trying to innovate with something new where your risk of doing something different immediately makes you a target, or the risk of simply covering routine care for people, all the citizens in emergency rooms, they don't have to travel to two or three others, that has to be taken care of, both for the safety and for the cost.
Okay. Dr. Koenig? Take it out of the hands of Congress?
Well, it's interesting that except for very few members of Congress, commissions don't deliver health care. And it's been interesting to me that the first 2 hours we've talked about rearranging the deck chairs on the payment, but we've not talked about what's broken is how we're delivering health care. We have the most fragmented system in the world. We pay for episodes, and our payment system fosters more widget production. 75% of the costs in this country are due to chronic disease. And what I'll say is the lack of managing that with aligned providers and health systems that can wrap supports around patients that to minimize the cost of their disease, follow evidence-based medicine. When people can't afford or take their $4 generic medicine and we're going to mandate personalized medicine, I think we have a mismatch if these mandates come down from Congress without having the providers at the table and really giving them some control of the finances.
Okay. One thing I didn't say about Dr. Mongan that would be good to know in his background is that earlier in his career he served on the staff of the Senate Finance Committee in Washington. So he's been there. He's worked in Congress. He knows how it works or doesn't work. So keep that in mind as Jim responds to the general question.
Thanks, John. I'm actually a little reluctant to have to go right to the organizational issue of what the congressional and executive branch structure looks like because I agree with the previous speaker. There's some incredibly important underlying issues which we'll get a chance to address in a moment, I believe. But just to answer that question. My own belief is that intellectually something like a Federal Reserve makes sense. I'm not at all sure yet whether politically it makes sense. When I started with the Finance Committee, Medicare was just 3 years old. This was the late 60s. And frankly, senators didn't understand it. They were bored with it. There wasn't a lot of money involved. Now it's a huge source of campaign cash coming into people who serve on the health committees. And whether they want to let that kind of power go, or whether now that kind of power has been outweighed by the incredible hassle of having to deal with these complex issues, I think is the equation that we'll see play out a little bit over the course of the next year. So intellectually, I'm for it. Politically, I'm not yet certain whether there's the ability to move in that direction.
Mm-hmm. Bill, you've dealt with a different set of congressional committees, the Armed Services Committees, in relation to your responsibilities at the Pentagon. What's your thought about the structure?
Well, I think the structure and the suggestion is one we should consider, with this caveat, the words GSE, government-sponsored entity, are not very popular this week. Mm-hmm. And so at the risk of saying that we need yet another government-sponsored entity, agree with Jim about the political liability there. What I experienced in trying to manage a large, complex federal health care program was, in spite of all my prior experience in the private sector and actually a short stint early in my career in Medicare, was, and I'm sure every federal health leader would say the same thing, was a lot of frustration. Frustration because I saw things that could be improved, managed better, for a lower cost every day. But our hands were tied because Congress, I'm not trying to bash Congress. Congress, individually and collectively feel as if they need to respond to the public and to all their constituencies. But it's not a way to run an efficient healthcare organization. So my answer would be yes, something not a federal reserve board for healthcare, but something like we had with the base realignment and closure with the military, which was not a permanent, it was a permanent law, it wasn't a permanent commission. It was a commission that reconvened every 5, 6, 7 years. You can decide what the right interval would be for health care. They dealt only with the highest level policy issues. In other words, that commission did not get into the business of trying to tell the Department of Defense how to run business every day. In fact, the recommendations they considered came from the Department of Defense, that administration, whether it was Republican or Democrat, and then they got reviewed, and then they got put to Congress in an up or down vote. So I think something that is not a Federal Reserve Board, something that's not just letting Congress trying to manage this on its own, but is in between, that is a periodic review that looks at the high-level policy issues for these programs, would be something that the next president, whoever that is, and the next administration ought to seriously consider.
Mm-hmm. Okay. You'll note that four of our panelists are physicians and one is an economist. And Dr. Koenig brought up the question or expressed concern about the fact that in many instances physicians are not part of the formula or solution when it comes to allocating resources on some kind of a collective basis. But I think back, Hank, to your book of probably 25 years ago now that was republished a few years ago, where you looked at closely the National Health Service in England and the role that physicians played there. And basically, to simplify it, obviously, the NHS is run under a tight budget. There's so much money available every year, and basically providers, physicians, hospitals, so forth, are told this is your money. You make the professional decisions of how it should be allocated. I wonder, Hank, if you could say a word or two about that, as you recall the work you did those years ago with Bill Schwartz. And whether in the context of the U.S., given its pluralism, the complexity, et cetera, whether you could see a role, a different role, that the medical profession could play in terms of allocating resources, not simply on a patient-by-patient basis, but on some kind of a collective basis that would have their professional knowledge and judgment involved in some kind of, again, a collective way in allocating resources in a more cost-efficient fashion.
John, if you hadn't mentioned the 4-to-1 ratio of physicians to economists in this panel, I was planning to do so. And the reason I was planning to do so is that I find it embarrassing and counterproductive when the ratio is reversed. And the reason is that I don't think that sensible health care reform can be made without a major, even a principal input from those people who understand what the delivery of health care means from their own personal experience. So I think this ratio is closer to right than the one to which I'm most accustomed. Now, with respect to the book on comparing Britain and the United States, there's actually a second book. It came out three or four years ago. If you'd like a copy, it's still in print from Brookings Institution. Give me your card and I'll make sure you get one. What is the relevance of the British experience right now to current American experience? I think, notwithstanding my assumptions of a long time ago, the relevance is exceedingly limited. The reason it's exceedingly limited goes to national tradition and values, the institutional and governmental framework that exists in Britain, and that does not exist here. We have a very they have a parliamentary democracy, party discipline. Simply say the term party discipline about American parties and you can listen a laugh. And we have a governmental system that is guaranteed to frustrate large action except when there are overwhelming majorities in favor of a particular course of action. No such overwhelming majorities exist now with respect to the directions that health insurance reform should take. I think we are at a much different position. I think our first challenge is actually to make sure that everybody is insured or has the opportunity to be insured. Different ways have been proposed to do it, but that's an essential first step, because if we ever get to the point where we try to limit how much is spent on low benefit or no benefit care, and some people are outside the system, they are going to lose access to care that they now enjoy, because hospitals and physicians can provide it, and they do, and then collect a little bit more from those payers who are taking care of the rest of us. I think the position we're in right now, and I want to come back to my initial theme, is improving the information we have about the relative cost and effectiveness of the things we do. And I'd like to give, if I could take a moment, to give a specific example. Back in the 80s and 90s, there was an explosion in the procedure of carotid endarterectomies. That led to skepticism in the analytical community that these were all worth doing. The RAND Corporation undertook a major set of studies led by a physician named Robert Brooke that concluded a third of the procedures were really not indicated, a third really were, and a third were equivocal. No change in rules, just a change in information. The rate of carotid endarterectomies dropped by 50% over a period of a few years. Then there was a blinded trial in which people were assigned with indicated conditions either to receive the procedure or not to receive it, and were followed for a period of time afterwards. The mortality rate and the complication rate among those who were assigned to medical management rather than surgery was so much higher that they had to stop the experiment because failure to give access to the procedure to those who were in the medical treatment wing of the experiment was considered immoral. That was an additional piece of information. The rate of the procedure then returned to close to its initial level. Now, I'm not suggesting that this is a procedure that's always used correctly or incorrectly. I am suggesting that the power of information to guide physicians who want to do the right thing is powerful, and right now we simply haven't studied adequately the bulk of what that $2 trillion on medical spending is going for.
Dr. Bean?
My comment about this is that we're paying more and more attention to the use of guidelines. There's always a defensiveness about guidelines and cookbook medicine in the beginning. Doctors don't want to be told what to do. We're trained. We know what to do. We don't want some bureaucrat telling us what to do. But you're right. Information is powerful, and it does make a difference if it's right information. So we've got to do the studies, and we are looking at doing the studies, and we have guideline committees in our professional societies that are gathering the evidence, good evidence, not shoddy evidence, good evidence, a piece at a time, and trying to put together the puzzles of what works and what doesn't. We're not trying to do cost effectiveness. We're trying to do what clinically is effective. Now, some studies sound good in the beginning, and they're just bad. There's something called a sports study. It studied the outcome of lumbar disc surgery, and they were allocated according to intent to treat. It concluded that it didn't matter whether you had surgery or not, it came out the same. Over a third of the people in the non-surgery group crossed over as they couldn't stand it. But they are accounted to the non-treatment group. Now, that made no sense. It turned out that the best outcome was when the patient was able to make a decision about how severe it was, how it affected him, and what was the right thing to do. And that's called flexibility. That's exceptions to the rule. We want to look at the rules, look at the evidence, but a doctor's here to help make the right choice and see when the rule doesn't apply. So I think it does make a difference. Outcomes will make a difference, and it will help constrain costs. But a one size doesn't fit all.
Sure. Let me refocus my question, because the central query I have is really the role that the medical profession plays in reform going forward. Many physicians are frustrated with the system, understandably, for reasons we've heard this morning. There are countless, I bet several hundred organizations in Washington that represent different slices of the medical profession, and they're all pursuing their own individual professional interests. And I think it's fair to say that oftentimes when people meet in Washington, policy staff, congressional staff, whatever, one of the missing interests at the table is the profession. And the question I would like to ask the three physicians here that will respond are, if the system that the profession has now for advocating on behalf of its interests and those of its patients is not working very well, how might you change it so the voice of the profession can be be heard in a more visible and responsible way?
Well, one thing is physicians are trained very autonomously, and we're trained that way because we do have to make decisions. But the training has also changed over the past, I'd say, 20 years, because healthcare is not silo care, which what we have now. It's very complex. It has biopsycho and social implications. And what physicians are doing, at least in my part of the world, we have aligned with our health system. And we, as a system of providers, not just physicians, not just a hospital, not just APNs, not just home care, but as a system, we stepped up, being the largest employer in our community, and said, we're going to do something different. We're going to take the risk. We're going to decide the 85% that follow the guideline and the 15% that don't. Okay? Mr. Aaron brought up carotid endarterectomy. That's a very hot topic right now in our community, because non-providers of care have come to town with ultrasound screening. And I'm getting a little off, but if you could bear with me. They're going to churches, and they're telling people they need this. They need to be screened. There's not one study that shows, without clinical situations, that ultrasonography of your retinas, your carotids, your abdomen, your legs is going to make one difference. But people hear this. They don't have a good source of medical information, because a lot of people don't have primary care, because we don't value that in our country. They go, they spend out-of-pocket money, which then led, in one case in our city, to an inappropriate carotid endarterectomy on an 89-year-old who was functioning extremely well at home. All her activities of daily living, even her IADLs. But there was a surgeon outside of our system who operated on her. She was then placed in a nursing home for her remaining 6 weeks of life. So until the providers of communities, because healthcare is delivered locally, get together and say, we're going to do things differently, we're going to change things, I think we have a big issue. Mm-hmm. And that's why I came here, to try to get that message out and get people to see that it's not just rearranging one thing at the top. Our payment system right now will pay a doctor for that carotid endarterectomy even if it doesn't meet the guidelines. And it is clear on the guidelines at which levels you do the procedures. So as a provider community in our health system, we've stepped up. We don't have all the answers, and we have conflicts. But you have to start somewhere. And I think you need to start with the providers.
Mm-hmm. The focus, again, of the panel is around costs. Jim Mongan, you were on the Hill for a fairly long time. You've had a variety of roles in medicine and government and so forth. What's your take on the role that physicians should play when it comes to the broad question of costs?
John, I think they should play a broader role than they do now. I agree that the most important way they can do that is by moving to end the fragmentation in medicine, where we've got tens of thousands of small practices, and for physicians to work in their communities into aggregating those into more organized groups, and then they will have a larger voice. You know, John, I answered your question crisply. Having flown all the way down here, I'd like to take 3 minutes to just do a mini filibuster
Okay. And
lay out some of my thoughts with respect to this issue. I suspect from the audience reaction in the previous session that most of what I have to say will not be well received, but I think I should say it anyway. I want to mention 3 things that I think we as providers should be doing to control costs. I want to mention 2 barriers that I think hold us back from doing that, and then 3 quick policy recommendations. The things we should be doing is we should be looking much closer at this issue of variance of care around the country. The work done up at Dartmouth about the variance in practice patterns is stunning, with huge economic and quality consequences. It's been ignored for decades. We have to stop that. We have to look at variance. A second thing we have to look at is process improvement within our organizations. Healthcare organizations do not operate as efficiently as other industries, and we should stop that. And the third thing we should do is look at these enormous administrative costs. And I would point out to you that those come in good part from the fact that we, the American people, want a public-private fee-for-service system, which leads to very large costs for reserves, for overheads, for profits, for billing, for compliance. We've got to look at that more closely. The 2 barriers, the payment system is totally broken. Unfettered fee-for-service reimbursement is an engine for inflation, nothing more nor less. We have to at least have pay-for-performance on that fee-for-service, and we should move further towards capitation. We've got to end the fragmentation in medicine and move towards more organized groups. Thousands of fragmented practices can't implement electronic records and can't form a culture to appropriately use those records. Now, as far as 4 quick policy recommendations, I would say reforming the payment system has got to be number 1. Hank's suggestion about some kind of effectiveness review body is a clear number 2 in my mind. Going forward with electronic records is a number 3 in my mind. And a continued and more intense focus on the sickest patients, 10% of patients accounting for 70% of costs, more focus on disease management is number 4. I apologize for the mini filibuster, but I had something to say and I wanted to say it.
Very succinct. And not everybody disagrees with you, James. Bill?
Including me. I agree with a lot of what Jim had to say. I want to try to answer your question about the role of physicians, but I first want to answer the central question we were asked as a panel, very briefly, is are we paying too much? I want to vote on this right now. Are we paying too much for what we're getting? Are we getting value? I think the answer is unequivocally, we are paying too much. We're not getting the value that we should out of the dollars. What's my evidence for that? Why am I absolutely convinced of that? First, I've spent the last 25 years working in this system, either as a physician, working and negotiating with hospitals, negotiating with Jim at Blue Cross, or at negotiating on the provider side or the government side. And I see inefficiencies abound, whether it's the administrative side, the variation in clinical practice. It's just, you know, we just are swimming in inefficiency. So I want to make that point. As far as the role of physicians, We're all physicians. I took that call early and sought to get training in business and in policy to have a part of my career focus on these kinds of issues. But I have to say this. I think in a system that it fits along the lines of what I thought we heard this morning in the earlier panel, physicians can play a tremendous role working with patients. I think more decision-making in the hands of physicians and patients making some of those trade-offs. They don't all have to be made in Washington at the senior level by the federal government or some Federal Reserve-like group. Yes, there's a need for physicians at the table at these policy discussions, but I would not underestimate in a world where patients have more information and act as consumers, where they have more financial, you know, as we call it, skin in the game, which I think we desperately need as part of the change. I think physicians and patients can make a lot of decisions, and this is empowering. So I think the roles are up and down the system. I want to finally say agree on the need for payment reform. We do not reward for quality, for efficiency, for outcome. And what's frustrating is if you are running a big program and you're trying to make those changes, it's very, very difficult to overhaul the payment system of Medicare. Extraordinarily difficult. And I'll say this, none of the private plans are going to change until Medicare makes a change. So government has a fundamental role here to make some of these critical changes in payment policy to put payments into bundles, to interject some risk and reward with the relationship with the providers and get out of piecemeal payments. So all of these things are important. I think I hear a number of agreement about a certain set of agenda issues that could be pursued. Mm-hmm.
Dr. Bean, let me ask you to respond to Jim Mangan's call for more aggregated delivery system, larger medical groups. I presume that you do not practice in a large group, but you'll have to tell me. But anyway, do you agree with that? Disagree? And if you agree somewhat, how would you take, you know, private businesses, mom and pops, single solo practitioners, two, threes, physicians, and tell them that they've got to, you know, team up and be 25 by, year 2010.
You can't do that overnight. I agree. It's quite possible for an integrated group to be able to work in a more coordinated fashion, even look at cost better, afford the systems, the IT systems, to look at it and get together. But you can't do that overnight. You can't take communities, which is the large majority of communities around the country, and suddenly say, you're all together or you're broke. Can't do it. So you've got to take it a piece at a time. You have to experiment a bit with payment, create incentives. Look, if you bundle payments that combines hospital and physician payments together, and the hospital's going to pay the physician, and he's going to have to scramble for what's going to be the first thing he's going to think, I need to get together with them somehow. I got to have a better relationship. So payment policy, yes, can make a difference and drive some of the change. Do I want to see it that way? No, I'm a little afraid how it might work. What might happen? So I want to see some examples of this. I don't want to see a wholesale change tomorrow. We have a cost crisis. We've had a cost crisis since 1970. It's like the medical liability crisis, a continuous crisis, and if we don't solve it today, we're going to still be trying to solve it. We need to begin solving a piece at a time. Find what works. Begin to create incentives to put people together when they haven't had 20 or 30 years to build these systems. We're going to do it a little faster because we have an incentive. But yes, we might be able to do it that way, but we can't just top-down unload a new payment system without giving us a chance to look at how it works in organizing ourselves. We've got to organize our finance, and we've got to organize our delivery system.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to ask Dr. Koenig to react, but before I just want to tell you, I'm going to turn to questions from you following her remarks. So if there are questions out there, there are three microphones across, and come to the microphone, identify yourself and your organization, and pose your question either to all of the panel or to one of the panelists. Dr. Keenan?
What we need to do is we need something between the revolution that would probably send people have less access because physicians would up and leave, and we can't wait for an evolution. And I agree, there's many ways private physicians can work with health systems. We have five different ways that we can partner with physicians in our area. We will employ physicians, we will do lease arrangements, we will do JVs, we will fund EMRs in community physicians. And I know you've done a lot of this because I've talked to your folks as well. But what we can't do is nothing. Okay? So the physicians, yes, it does take time, but we can't say no, no, no. But there are ways that when health systems are able to step up and say, we're going to develop the systems, not just the physicians and the providers, the nurse who goes home after a hospital admission to make sure that person doesn't readmit next week because they didn't understand their discharge instructions. It's this continuum of care that needs to develop in our country. And the way I would like to see government allow it to occur are to allow the health systems of regions and areas and large hospitals with small physicians groups and large physician groups. There's really been no increase in physician multi-groups in the past several years. It's kind of still a cottage industry. But that's okay as long as systems are willing to work with those and come up with a better way to deliver care. Because if we don't, we can cover everybody, but you're still going to have bad outcomes because it's going to be piecemeal, it's going to be in your emergency room, it's going to be in your OR, and there's going to be nobody connecting that care. Mm-hmm. I feel strongly.
I can't see. Are there questions out there? In the middle there?
I can't see it.
Yeah, yes, ma'am.
You don't know.
We can't hear you. The mic's not on, sir. No.
Is there? Okay.
There you go.
I'm Becky Cherney. I run the Florida Healthcare Coalition. I'm not a physician. We are payers. It's the largest employers in Florida. I have three things I'd like to ask whomever to address. The first is mandates. Can we stop at least doing the bad things we're doing? In Florida, we just had two mandates passed on health care, neither one of which meets the value equation in any shape or form. So on the schizophrenic, on one hand, we're saying we've got a $150 plan for people because we aren't doing the mandates. And then on the other hand, larger employers are stuck with two mandates, one of which has never been done before, and that's habilitative care for autism. So how do we stop mandates? Can the National Governors Association or somebody stop that until we get our arms around it? Second is compliance. The best physician in the world can't do anything for that patient who won't follow what they're supposed to do. There is no way. So how do we build compliance in and measure that and make the patients accountable if the doctor is supposed to be? And the last is on measurement. As payers, we don't think physicians are overpaid. We think basketball players are overpaid. But the reality is we can measure basketball players. We know how many points they scored, how many practices they went to. We know their productivity. What will you accept as physicians to at least start measurement? We agree the payment system's broken. We have HMOs, PPOs, EPOs, UFOs. It's broken. But that can be fixed. That's the easier part. But how can we stop mandates, improve compliance with patients, and get some measurements on physicians so that we can pay accordingly?
Bill?
Yeah. Having been in the health insurance sector, and having to deal with that, I can tell you that that's a big part of the cost structure. There's studies that have been pretty well researched that suggest that between 20 and 30% of the cost of a typical plan is embedded in or as a result of mandates. Now, what's one person's mandate is another person's critical benefit that they have to have. So these are tough issues. I think we've got to experiment like they're doing here in Florida and hopefully some other places to allow health plans to come in with lower cost plans with benefit structures that cover the catastrophic cost, but maybe have more cost sharing involved, maybe have some limitation of the benefit. You can't do away totally with the regulation. Then I think you end up with a very health insurers are going to behave in economic ways and will discard the unhealthy and take the healthy. So you can't totally discard the ground rules. But I do think that we've got to really press and bring attention to the fact that this is part of the cost problem.
Mm-hmm. Anybody else?
Yeah. One on the compliance. We do have what I call the Rescue Me Society in our country, unfortunately. We have the diabetes epidemic, and I don't think anyone will disagree. It's we eat wrong and we do these things. But the one thing I've learned, and I've been doing this for 16 years, actually crossed over to the dark side as well in the late 90s on the business side, the public sometimes needs help to be accountable, especially seniors. They don't really understand the instructions they're given. They try to save money by splitting pills. So you do have to do some education, and then you can expect the accountability. We're working with employers to do disease management programs that if the patients participate, their co-pays for their drugs are waived if they use generics. So I agree with you on the accountability. I think there are things we need to do, though, to help our public be more accountable.
Okay. The health system and the way physicians are paid does feed back into compliance in an important way. Let me give you a concrete example, and that is in the treatment of diabetes. McKinsey and Company, a number of years ago, did a very careful study comparing the treatment of people with three or four different conditions in the United States, Great Britain, and Germany. One of the conditions was diabetes. That was the only condition in which the British system won hands down over both the United States and Germany. And why was that? The reason for that was that the patients had access to pharmaceutical products at negligible cost. There was no idea here that they had to have skin in the game in order to buy effectively and choose among different products. And the British social system, medical system, had a well-developed system of nurse practitioners who followed up, visited people, checked on compliance. It wasn't simply the job of the physician. The United States had inferior performance in that dimension because we don't have those kinds of add-ons to the healthcare system. So we need to think about not only what physicians can do, but what the complementary services are that other healthcare professionals can offer that will help with compliance. The degree of noncompliance is absolutely staggering. I was quoted a statistic that 50% who are prescribed statins are noncompliant after 6 months. If you want to talk about something with relatively few side effects and no real reason not to stick with one's regimen, this is it. This is a massive problem to which a great deal more attention ought to be focused than we are now paying to
here
it.
And then. Okay, way in the back of the room, please.
David Tischer, orthopedic surgeon. You focus a lot on physician behaviors and physician structures, but really haven't talked about some very egregious practices by the healthcare industry, the commercial healthcare industry. I can tell you without a doubt that physicians are not being paid any more than they were 10 years ago, and yet the cost of premiums continues to escalate at a level that exceeds what the increase in cost of running our practice is. And we're getting squeezed to the point where we're really not even going to be able to function in this manner. The question I have is, what can we do about the record profits that the insurance companies are making and able to go into markets where there's very little competition, dominate a market, force physicians to sign contracts below their own costs, and yet we have CEOs with these golden parachutes bailing out with $100 million, and the percentage of premium dollar continues to be smaller and smaller that's spent directly on health care. I think there's an opportunity there, and I'd like to hear what your answer to that might be.
Well, go ahead.
I'll try one. What did Pogo say? We've met the enemy and he's us. The American people want a public-private system. They don't trust government. They want a buffer between them and government. The buffer is the insurance industry, and we're willing to pay those prices, including the golden parachute. So when the American public kind of look at this a little more, maybe their underlying view might change. But we're getting the kind of system that I think we as a people want, and I think that goes along with it.
Become your own insurance company.
The doctors are just as bright as the guys who run an insurance company. Get together, get your own insurance company, and pay yourself what you're worth. That's the answer.
Okay.
We have a question here.
Yes, here.
Hi there. I'm Jim Knight. I'm from San Diego. I'm CEO of Consumer Directed Healthcare. We have a doctrine of informed consent as physicians. The doctrine of informed consent means we don't do anything or not do anything without explicit approval of the patients we treat. We're talking about a system, a top-down system, where patients are spending other people's money, and of course those other people have an interest in how it's spent, so therefore we can devise a system of protocols and algorithms, and therefore we'll make this thing work because it's our money, not their money. But we're ignoring the underlying truth, which is patients have to be making these decisions themselves. What's wrong with giving half the money that goes into insurance back to the patient, let them make those decisions on the day-to-day health care, let some of the vertical siloed health care come together because it's entrepreneurially a good idea to offer global diabetic care to people who are paying their own bills and want good health. So why can't we move some of the money out of the OPM category and return it back to the consumer?
Yeah. I'll take that. Agree totally. I'm a member of a consumer-directed health plan with a health savings account. Personally, I've chosen that. And I'm a big believer in that as a very important thrust. I know there are concerns. People think, you know, it won't cover preventive care. The plans that do it include preventive care. I just can't see, my experience is over 25 years, it's very difficult to make these changes and trade-offs without the active engagement of the patient, of the individual. And together with the provider, I think they can make a lot of decisions, the best decisions, frankly, working together and looking at the trade-offs, looking at the costs. And you look at things differently when you have that money and you're spending. The other actors respond differently. For example, you take Walmart, what they did with, you know, $4 generic drugs. I have to believe that's very much driven by a consumer marketplace. And one of the things we found out in a survey, a major survey that was done with Deloitte, a consumer survey just last year, is that people want to be much more engaged in their health care. They want 60% of them would like to get their records online and interact with their physicians online. They'd like to take more responsibility, but the way the system's constructed right now, a lot of the control, a lot of the decision-making is, just as you've described, other people's money.
John, could I interject one point on the... right here. On the consumer-directed health plan. I'm a director of a medium-sized company. When the HSA law was enacted in 2003, another economist and I who were on that board, Joe Newhouse, who, a health economist who many of you know, and I said, you got to do this. You got to make this option available to employees. And you got to do it in a way where those who switch into the consumer-directed plan are protected. So the company deposited into the HSA 2/3 of the maximum allowed contribution. Everybody who would have switched into the HSA PPO plan that the company offered would have been financially better off in every conceivable circumstance. 1/4 of the employees made that decision. 3/4 did not. Some remained in. The number of enrollees has not gone up. That's an anecdote. Another fact, the Commonwealth Foundation has done surveys of satisfaction of people who are in consumer-directed health plans, who are in private non-government insurance plans, and who are covered by Medicare. Remember that every enrollee in a consumer-directed plan is in there voluntarily, except in those few cases where companies offer only a consumer-directed plan. So most of them are voluntary. The results indicate the level of satisfactions were highest with Medicare, next with private insurance, and lowest with the consumer-directed plans. Now, I'm not saying that as somebody who thinks that this is a bad option to make available. I'm for it, as I actually did in my capacity as a director. But I think we have to understand that if we're looking for a wellspring of enthusiasm moving in the direction of consumer-directed plans, it's not going to happen anytime soon.
Dr. Bean?
Yeah, I want to make one brief comment. In our own office, we moved from a PPO plan to an HSA, HRA plan. The cost dropped 40% overnight. Same benefits. Everybody had them. We don't have a complaint. They're able to participate. The more my employees or our patients can participate in their decisions, and if it involves them writing a check for at least the small ones, not the major catastrophic events, I think the better off we're going to be, because they're smart and they want to look at what they're getting and they want to see value in it. That's where you find value. People make their own decisions about it.
We have a question here.
Thank you. Ed Holman. I'm an orthopedic surgeon at the USF Medical School in Tampa and also a member of the Florida House of Representatives. And our nation's health care cost, the figures are a little flexible, maybe 30% genetic, which we're not really having control over, 40% are individually controlled by our behavior, and maybe 20% that we're talking about here that we are politically controlled, that we're trying to have some influence on. So it looks like the big money would be in, can we modify our nation's behavior instead of talking about disease management, can we somehow promote health? And in, there are some vague references to that. About 10% of the comments have to do with the patient participation, but 90% of it is we're talking about politics. Where can this panel take the care off of our title up there and talk about our health is at risk? And Dr. Kearney could probably go to this, and she's right in there with that, as to how, in your organization, what are you doing to make the patient think, it's my health I'm talking about, and I'm spending more money on my cat and my dog and my car than on me. More, not maybe money, more attention.
Well, one of the things I tell my patients, I still practice a small amount of my time, is I'm working harder than you are. And one thing is physicians have to have that dialogue with patients. From a system view, what we're doing is we're working with employers. We're giving people access to health and wellness programs. We will send on-site health physiologists. We will start educating people. Because while the Internet has been a great source of information, not all of it is good information. So we try to tailor it either at the employer level or at the Medicare level. We're doing education. We're getting those patients involved. We're trying to remove a barrier or actually incent them. If they work in one of our DM programs and they meet so many milestones, we will waive copays for their meds. So you do have to get patients to take accountability, but sometimes you do have to educate them to get them to understand that accountability. And there's a program out at Stanford for Medicare called Healthy You, where we've actually gone out to senior high-rises, and we have done on-site classes with not necessarily medical personnel, but trained lay leaders. And we're going to be able to show a huge return on investment by engaging those people in their health care so they don't have to see 13 different physicians. They know what to do a lot of the time.
We have a question here.
Where are you?
Hi, I'm Bill Obremski, orthopedic trauma surgeon at Vanderbilt. I do have an economics degree and a master's in health policy, if that matters. But my question is really to Dr. Koenig. And the Summa Health System is a great enlightened vision in terms of minimizing the representation or the incentive of providers to maximize revenue, and of insurance companies to minimize expense by coordinating all of the above, all together. And in an effective way, you're trying to engage the patients in the process as well. My question is, that's great if I'm a small business in your area and all my employers work there. What if I'm Verizon, or which is multi-state, multinational, or Medicare, which is clearly much larger? How could that system be in place at a larger scale to satisfy those larger areas?
Well, I think some policy has to be developed to allow what's happened, not just in, at SUMA, but in Sentara, in Presbyterian, in Intermountain Health. I think that development, again, it's not going to be a revolution, but it can't be a slow evolution either. But if policy could allow that development of regionalization of the providers from all the different sides, and there's still conflict. We still have docs that want to own their own MRI scanner. And we have a doc who I had to call last week wants to order an MRI before he examines the patient. But because we have a system and we have committees of physicians who said that's not right, we are able to put that dollars for those care somewhere else. And when we're profitable, we then send that money back into our system for our indigent care. We're also the safety net hospital. So that's where the policy can help, so that these regional areas can happen, because healthcare is local. It's delivered between a doctor and a patient, or a nurse and a patient.
Yes, sir. Then we'll go back over here.
Hi, my name's Wayne Strauss. I'm here even though I can't afford to be, because I'm a family physician in a rural area. And actually, it's probably one of the only side comments I'd like to make is I think it's been great bringing different people here with different perspectives. And I'm kind of worried that the primary care, rural, small, solo dinosaur guy doesn't have that perspective here. We're talking about big things. I hope you can affect those big things, and I hope that sometimes at some point they'll creep into the rural environment as well. I guess I have one question with Teresa. I think SUMA is doing a great doing the right thing, and I think the only thing that's missing is it needs to be national. We need to have one system, because one of the questions that I have is what happens to the patient in my area. It's a rural, but it's also a resort kind of area, so people will spend half their year in upstate New York, where I live, and half the year in Florida. I'd kind of like to know what would happen to a person in your system if they live like that. And then the second question, one of the things I really worry about is the unintended consequences. The P4P scares the pants off me. I almost came in here with a bathing suit because I wanted to show how much it scared me.
No, that would have been a lot of pretty stuff.
P4P, I think our biggest problem is we're saying that we understand how to measure quality. We don't have any idea how to measure quality. That is, I mean, to say that's in infancy, it's fetal stage. And we've got much more to learn, and that's what scares me. There are lots of things that will happen. We don't have a P4P in my area, although they're trying to push for it. What worries me is what happens to the very difficult patient. And I'll try to do this very quickly. I have a lady that I followed for 13 years, who, when I first met her, said, I'm going to kill myself when my youngest daughter turns 16. I've seen her over the last 13 years, sometimes once a week, sometimes once every 2 weeks. She's an incest survivor, both parents and a brother. Horrible situation. Actually, a nice person, believe it or not. The insurance company that I work with came to me and hit me twice. Number one is I saw my patients too much. And number two is I didn't do a pap smear on her. What happens when we start doing P4P to make sure we don't have the unintended circumstance where we're pushing patients out of the process altogether?
Okay. Dr. King?
Yeah, first let me answer quickly. We do have what the term, and I didn't invent this, and it's called snowbirds. The people that are fortunate enough to come down here when it's, you know, beautiful weather. What we do on these people is we still try to have nurses in contact with them when they're down here. Okay. So if they need some chronic care, we get contracts with providers down here to do their INRs, their Coumadin monitoring. The question of P4P, and we agree with you, it's very difficult. We build our P4Ps, and we've had some successes and some failures. We did it with our physicians at the table. Instead of monitoring, did you do the checkbox or did you not do the checkbox, we're trying to do different things. A great example right now is we found in our Medicare and our commercial population, the cost of having diabetes and cardiovascular disease, when you add depression, goes up 100%. So what we're doing a P4P with our physicians is to screen the person for depression. Because you can check boxes that don't change the outcome. But if we can incent our docs by giving them additional revenues, or we're helping put EMRs in offices, if we can screen those people for depression, and then if they screen positive, put the care supports around them, they have better outcomes, and guess what? We don't spend as much money, so we have more money to do more P4Ps. So the physicians have to be at the table for these P4Ps. I mean, my biggest concern is patients are going to be dropped because, you know, we all have non-compliant patients.
Yeah.
And there's no way to figure out you have three and you have two.
Yeah.
So my concern for patients is they're going to be dropped, because a lot of time the non-compliance may not even be of their choice. It may be, but they'll be dropped.
Just a quick comment. It is a major policy conundrum of how you relate changing the delivery system to changing the payment system. You can't do effective pay for performance with a small individual practice. It doesn't make sense, and you should be scared of it. You need a larger, more organized group to do pay for performance, but how do you get from where you are to a larger, more organized group? They're inextricably linked, and nobody has solved that Gordian knot yet.
Okay. I apologize to those who have not been able to ask a question, but I am told by my handlers that we have not only run out of time, but exceeded time. So please join me in thanking the panel for their
and the employees of the table.
The panelists assure me they will be around if people want to single them out and ask a question of them. And so we'll move on to our next speaker. Thank you. Thanks. Yeah, thank you. Actually, the most surprising thing I heard in that discussion was Dr. Bean suggesting that he was attracted to the notion of bundled payments. I hope he does not get run out of his association when they hear about that. But the Medicare Payment Advisory Commission is strongly backing that, as well as others. Well, obviously, we're in the midst of a historic election coming up in November. Whatever the result, we'll witness a significant milestone in the history of our country. And it goes that without saying that whatever occupies the next, whomever occupies the next White House, will have an enormous impact on the shape and direction of not only the economy, but healthcare reform, foreign policy, et cetera. To tell us how the Democratic nominee, Barack Obama, would approach the issue of health care reform, I'm pleased to introduce one of his leading surrogates, Dr. Erwin Redliner of New York. He's a national co-chair for Doctors for Obama Biden and an associate dean and professor of clinical public health of pediatrics at Columbia University. Additionally, he is president and co-founder of the Children's Health Fund, along with Paul Simon. It focuses on developing health programs in the nation's most medically underserved urban and rural areas. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Erwin Redliner.
Hi, thank you. Is this going to be a friendly audience, Jim?
This will be a friendly audience,
good.
I assure you.
Dr.
Redliner is going to lay out the Obama view on healthcare, and I may ask him a quick question or two, but then I will definitely want to get to your questions, and hopefully, probably it's best if people have a question, maybe to gravitate towards the sides of the room. I think there are people with microphones there, instead of just standing up right away, or, you know, we'll get a microphone to you. Dr. Redliner.
Thanks, Jim. And I really do want to encourage you to ask me, grill me, whatever you want to call it afterwards, because I think it's really important that we understand exactly what we're talking about when it comes to Senator Obama and Senator Biden's ideas about health care and what needs to happen. And I could actually introduce this by saying that you know, the amount of money being spent on our healthcare system now, you probably have heard some of this already in the conference, is over $2 trillion a year. It's 14% or 16% of the GDP. It's heading, if we don't do something about it, to a $4 trillion annual tab. And we still have in the mid-40 millions people, Americans, that are not insured. And more than that, a lot of people who are insured who do have coverage, and I have people actually in my family, in my neighborhood, who have coverage but are experiencing all the travails of what coverage in America means in 2008, which is it's lousy, it's inadequate, it's a hassle, and if you're really sick and need it, it's just absolutely terrifying. So I could do that more expansively, but I really want to mention a couple of other things. And I'm a pediatrician. I practiced pediatrics for a while, though now in an academic setting, and run a national program for medically underserved children. And I was a pediatric ICU director before. I just wanted to establish my creds here with this audience. I know from whence you come, and I have been there, and I'm very, very concerned about a number of things having to do with the quality and ability to practice effectively and successfully in the United States today. But I want to just tell you one quick thing that came from my daughter-in-law when she was a resident at a big New York City hospital. This is a year ago. She's now a young working physician. And we were talking about healthcare costs, and she said, do you know what happens when we get a complicated patient referred in from, I'm not going to mention the names of the hospitals, another big medical center across town, about 4 miles away. When they have just had a workup and they come into our ER, since we cannot get the medical records, the entire workup is repeated, everything. The blood work, the x-rays, the special studies, and so forth. And this happens all day long, every day, in almost every healthcare delivery site in the United States. This kind of crazy system of people ordering lots of things, the healthcare costs going up, and it's really breaking the back of our ability to afford a rational healthcare system. And so if you take the family issues, which we're all familiar with, you take what's happened to the quality and ability to practice medicine in the United States, and you take the cost issues, we're looking at, and this term is so overused, I even hate to mention it, but a true crisis in America. And in fact, I was just telling someone a few minutes ago that we're looking right now at a financial meltdown in the banks and the lending institutions, that it's, you know, big banner headlines in every newspaper in the country. I'm telling you that we're on the verge of something very similar in the healthcare system, because if we don't do something, the country literally cannot afford a $4 trillion price tag. We can't even afford the $2 trillion price tag of today. So imagine yourself if we could turn that the hands of time back a year vis-a-vis the financial crisis. That's where we're sitting right now with the healthcare situation. So, as I say, it affects individuals, it affects our economy, it affects our country, it affects our morale as a country in terms of what we can do and how we need to do it. So Barack Obama, in laying out his plan, has been very clear about a couple of basic things. First of all, some goals. So the goal is to have everybody in the system. You cannot have a rational system of health care in a modern industrialized country if there are large numbers of people who are being excluded for whatever reason. It doesn't work. And we can go into why it actually doesn't work later if we need to. So we have a goal of getting everyone in the system. We have a second goal, that we have to make it affordable. It's related to the first goal, because if it's not affordable, people won't be able to be in the system. And the third goal is that we have to deal with issues that have to do with the quality of practice and the cost efficiency of practice. What are we doing? What exactly are we paying for? How are we paying for it? And those goals really are the roadmap, so to speak, for the other specific proposals that the Democrats are proposing in their presidential and vice presidential candidates. So I want to sort of lay out a little bit of detail about that. Not too much, because you can, as I said, just ask me anything you want about some of the specifics. The issue about affordability, by the way, I always include under a slightly larger umbrella, which I refer to as healthcare security for people. Because if we're going to make the thing right, it not only has to be affordable, but you cannot be sitting around your kitchen table worried that the test came back in a not a good way that you just had, and you're not sure whether your insurance is going to cover it or not, cover the condition and the treatment. So we have to make the coverage stable as well as affordable, so that there's no question in your mind that whatever you have, whatever you develop, you will be covered. And not only that, the other part of security is if you lose your job that had health care with it, you must know that you'll be able to pick up and get health care otherwise. I have a 40-year-old son, it's frightening, but I do, who was in the financial sector, who has now been unemployed for a year and is struggling. His COBRA is about to run out. He has diabetes. So it is unimaginably frightening if you're in that situation. And Obama says we can't have that. So there's going to be a series of new rules, a new playing field under an Obama-driven health care plan. And some of them are a little more involved than others, but here's the basic rules. No one can be denied coverage by an insurance company. That is going to become a thing of the past. Secondly, pre-existing conditions, new conditions develop, none of those can affect either what you're paying for health insurance or your ability to have health insurance. Your job will not be a determinant of whether you have health care or not. I know personally people who would like to change jobs, who would like to move to a different part of the country, but live in fear that if they change those jobs, they'll lose their coverage and they won't be able to get covered again. That is not right. So those are new rules for the insurance companies and their ability and how they practice. Does it need to be regulated? Absolutely does. It absolutely needs to be regulated. And it will be regulated under President Obama. Second new rule. If you have a child up through the age of 25, you must get coverage for that child, period. We want to have children not be subject to the political whims and fancies of the day, and maybe they'll get coverage, maybe SCHIP will be expanded, maybe it won't. It's a political football. The SCHIP expansion bill went to the president twice, vetoed it twice. Congress couldn't override the veto. It's ridiculous. As a pediatrician, a father, and a grandfather, the very fact that there's still 9 million kids without insurance, never mind the insured kids who don't have coverage because they live in medical shortage areas, it is unconscionable. That is an irrevocable part of the agenda that Barack Obama put forward. Yeah, while we're waiting to fix the rest of it, every child in America up to the age of 25 will get coverage, period. They'll be enrolled in schools. They'll be enrolled if they come to an emergency room. Every point of contact will be a potential opportunity to enroll a kid. But at the end of the day, every child will be covered. And the third rule that's of importance here is that if you are a company, a large company, and what we mean by large will be worked out later. That will be a negotiation with Congress. But let's say 25 or 50 employees or more, you must provide coverage for your employees. And if you don't provide coverage, then you must contribute to a public plan that anybody can get into. So it's a pay or play kind of thing, but you've got to be in the game. So those are the basic tenets of what Obama is proposing as rules. The third thing is he is a very big and deep believer in the concept of modernizing American health care. The story I told you about my daughter-in-law and having to repeat tests, this is out of the question. We've got to deal with this. It's going to require a significant investment in health information technology, electronic health records, and so forth and so on. We'll have to deal with the HIPAA issues, but I don't want doctors in Hospital A repeating the entire workup from Hospital B. It just doesn't make sense. It's not good for patients. It's not good for the system. It's not good for the cost of care. Also, we have to figure out what do we want to be paid for by our healthcare system. And it's not just surgery. We've got to be able to reimburse primary care doctors for time they spent dealing with prevention, with chronic disease management. It is, again, ridiculous that doctors can't practice what they know they should be doing. They can't spend the time to talk about smoking cessation or obesity prevention and so forth because they have to churn out patients that they'll get reimbursed for. And so modernizing healthcare in America includes looking at what we're going to pay for and what is understood to be part of the bargain that you make when you are an American citizen. This is what you should be getting out of your healthcare arrangements, and modernizing it with technology are key factors in his plan as well. Now, what troubles me, I just want to say this before, and then Jim's going to ask a couple of questions. As many questions as you want, really. You're the moderator. And
you're
then
doing great.
You'll ask me a lot of questions, too. But, you know, I just need to say a word about the other side. And I don't really like to be critical. And in fact, I know Senator McCain, and I've met with Senator McCain and discussed a lot of issues with him. But I am astounded that a modern American politician thinks that it is okay, not that he'll say this, but their policies reflect it, that it's okay that the system basically trundles along the way it's been going, and that millions of Americans are not in the system, and that you'll do something to the tax benefits of employers and employees so that they'll be forced out of their employer relationships and go into the open market without any controls or regulations on the insurance companies, without any sense that you'll increase the tax subsidies that people will get anything more than inflation. You know, if you take 2000 and you look at 2000 compared to 2007, so the average wages increased by 24% from 0 to 07. The average cost of health care rose 98% in that same time period. Medical and health care inflation way outstrips the regular inflation rates. So even if you got some benefit initially, this is a criticism just been in very widely published just a few days ago, that Senator McCain's plan might initially bring another 20 million or so, 21 million is actually what's predicted, people into insurance. By the end of 10 years, 20 million of them will have no longer been able to afford it. In other words, the medical cost inflation, since there won't be any controls there, will outstrip what people are getting as subsidies, and you'll end up with, even after 10 years, maybe, if you're lucky, a million more people in the system. And to me, in a country that is trying to right itself economically and is trying to make it possible for people and families to achieve their dreams without having to worry about whether their surgery or their chemotherapy or whether children's health care is going to be covered, I just don't get it. Now, there may be many roads to getting to universal affordable care, but we're only hearing one side even talking about the primacy and the sanctity of having important goals that really matter to our country. So let me leave it at that, and hopefully we won't see the political dialogue over this remaining 6 or 7 weeks or whatever's left degenerating into name-calling, that any attempt to fix the system and you wait and see is going to be characterized as a government health care system or worse, socialized medicine. And hopefully people have gotten beyond accepting that kind of rhetoric and characterization. You know, if they're so threatened by government in medicine, what are we supposed to expect, that they'll, will they dismantle Medicare? That's government, isn't it? Medicaid, SCHIP, a lot of things are government. What is it that they're signaling if they're trying to instill fear about appropriate government involvement, not over-involvement, not over-bureaucratization, but appropriate regulation and involvement so that people can get what they need at an affordable price? So let me leave it at that. I hope I didn't rile them up too much.
No, you're just fine. Let me just ask you a quick question that sort of relates to access, though. You say that the Obama plan has lots of new rules. Other people call those mandates. You will mandate certain things on the insurance companies
right.
to cover people. You mandate
right.
people pay have their kids.
Yeah.
You mandate that employers either make a meaningful contribution
right.
to or contribute to a public health care plan. What's wrong with an individual mandate? On the first panel that we had here today, we had people as diverse as John Engler, representing the National Association of Manufacturers, to Andy Stern of the SEIU, basically saying, yeah, we could all live with some form of an individual mandate.
Well, I don't think you're asking me what's wrong with
that. Well, or why doesn't, I mean, Senator Obama does not have an individual mandate.
Why doesn't
in
he
his
go
plan.
To a, yeah, okay.
Senator Clinton did have an individual
yeah.
mandate. Senator Edwards did have
yeah.
an individual mandate. Why not an individual mandate?
Well, because there's the question is whether it's politically viable or not. We're in a presidential race that is nasty, difficult, intense, and I'm not sure that, although you say it and your very educated panel said it, I'm not sure that the American heartland that, I don't know how far I should go on this, but
go right
well, the American heartland that seems to be enthralled with the fact that governor of a small populated state, who was a former mayor of a town of 6,000, is a good idea to have his, you know, heartbeat away from the presidency. I'm not sure how ready the country is politically to accept an overall mandate. Would I personally prefer it? I would prefer a mandated health care system in the country. I think it's the only way that ultimately will control costs, but there may be ways of getting to universal without mandating.
Okay. Do we have some questions? Does somebody have a microphone with them by any chance? We don't need one?
They're going to speak loudly.
Okay.
They're carrying a big stick and speaking
okay.
loudly.
Okay. Let's start with the guy with the mic, and then we'll move it around.
My name is Baron Lohner. I'm a spine surgeon in New York, and I appreciated your comments, Dr. Redliner. And I think the goals of the Obama plan are admirable, but what is the estimated cost of this plan, and how do you what are your plans for coverage, and how will this be paid for, number one? And number two, nowhere in your plan did I hear anything about medical liability reform. I have a personal family member who's a prominent knee surgeon in Philadelphia. He is a skilled surgeon. He's an excellent doctor. And he's faced with bankruptcy over a bogus lawsuit.
Right. Well, actually, let me deal with the second question first. I actually meant to talk about that. So malpractice and malpractice insurance and liability is a very complex problem and a very costly one. And the defensive medicine practices are obviously a contributor to the cost of care in the country. There's a number of ways of dealing with this. Texas is doing an experiment, as you probably know, where they limit liability or damages and so forth. And Senator Obama does not agree to that. And let me tell you what he does think, however. You know, there's 100,000 people die in hospitals every year, roughly, because of errors. 90% of those errors are not physician negligence. They are system problems. They are breakdowns in information transfer. They're things happening to doses, to equipment, to the decision-making process in general. 90% of those deaths are not about physician negligence. And the question is, what is it that we can do to reduce that number to an absolute minimum? And there's a lot that can be done to do that. And it starts with appropriate use of technology in hospital systems. That the better we get at that, and the more we invest in quality technology, the more we will have a significant impact on the prevalence of those kinds of injuries and deaths. And this is something that is a first order of business for Senator Obama. The second thing is, and this has been shown repeatedly or in various demonstration projects around the country, that if you can keep cases out of the courtroom by arbitrated settlements, by doing things around the patient-doctor-hospital-patient relationships to cause settlements to happen that are not in the courts, you can dramatically reduce the number of lawsuits, the number of lawyers who are dependent, their income being dependent on malpractice suits, bogus and otherwise, and you can have a gigantic impact on both the quality of the care at the same time as you are reducing the frequency of malpractice litigation and therefore the cost associated with malpractice premiums. And the other issue is that Senator Baum is very interested in are antitrust matters in terms of fee setting by malpractice insurance companies. There are some things there that need to be looked at. This goes back to this issue of appropriate and relevant amounts of regulation in the systems that can make things better in terms of quality of practice and a lot of the cost issues. So that's more or less where he's coming from on the malpractice issue. So, and the first...
Pay for it.
Okay. Yeah, so the mechanisms to pay for anybody's proposals include a number of different strategies. And so here's where they begin. First of all, there's going to be an infusion of money in the system when the tax benefits enjoyed by the upper 2% of the population in terms of income are eliminated. We need to go back to what they were, you know, a decade ago and deal with some inequities in the system that are allowing a lot of people to take money out of the system, and we have to invest that in certain things. And one of the things that would be invested would be into the healthcare system. The second thing is that we're spending now between $35 and $40 billion a year on uncompensated care. People think it's free care. If you're not covered and they have to go see you or go to the emergency room, somebody's paying for that. And who ends up paying for it are taxpayers, to the tune of, as I say, $35 to $40 billion a year. Once we have everybody covered in the system, that money could be reinvested in the other improvements and in expanding access to health insurance. And then there are savings from reducing the bureaucracy and administrative costs when we do the right thing that we need to do with technology and the streamlining of healthcare and the reduction of administrative costs. And finally, there are benefits to be gained from real investments in prevention and chronic disease management. So those sources combined will really help pay for the improvements in the medical system and in the access to the healthcare system that we need to make.
My next question is in the back.
Back here.
Okay.
Hi, Laurel Herbst. I'm a hospice doc from San Diego.
Where are you, Laurel? Oh, there you are. Okay, yeah.
I come from a community with great ethnic and cultural diversity, and I haven't heard much in any of the plans about how we're going to look at managing chronic diseases and illnesses in populations of people who have no cultural history with self-care, management of health care.
Yeah.
Somebody else makes decisions.
Right.
My Hispanic immigrant who lives on tortillas and beans will never follow an ADA diet. So how can we keep these people from accessing just our safety net providers? Are we going to look at some incentives in these health plans for helping care for these people?
Absolutely. And by the way, I forgot to mention this before, but especially for physicians in the audience, it really would be worth it to go to Senator Obama's presidential website and look at the details of the health care plan. I think you'll find it very interesting and very relevant to a lot of the issues that you're bringing up. But to get to your point, there are two connected issues here. One is, what is the healthcare system paying for? And two is, what are we going to do about the almost intractable disparities that exist in the healthcare system that are based on lots of different factors, including cultural and economic disparities and so forth, people getting different kinds of care for different reasons? And the disparities question is something that is very important to Senator Obama, him personally wanting to deal with that. And the other thing that he's very personally committed to is, as I was mentioning before a little bit, is what exactly do we want to pay for in the healthcare system? Do we want to continue to relegate ourselves to paying for acute illnesses and trauma and just the surgery or the 3 minutes that you have to prescribe somebody a new pill? Or do we want to actually look at what patients need and what doctors want to do and really figure out ways to reimburse people for time, doctors for time, to work with patients on managing chronic illnesses? I mean, can you imagine how great that would be if we all got paid for doing what we've been taught to do, which is to spend time with people? I mean, we have kids in our Children's Health Fund practices around the country with, you know, obesity and severe poverty, but obesity and diabetes and chronic and asthma and so forth, it is essential that doctors be allowed, and by allowed I mean reimbursed for, sitting down with a family and talking about how do you actually manage a child with asthma over the long haul. That's more than writing a prescription. But right now we're not getting paid for that. And it's a disaster. It's a disaster for the families and the children, obviously, and the parents, but it's also a disaster for we who are trying to practice quality medicine. So focusing on chronic disease management, preventive services, and dealing with disparities are very foremost in Senator Obama's plan.
Do we have somebody with a mic?
We have our next question here.
Okay.
Thanks. Mary O'Connor, orthopedic surgeon, Jacksonville, Florida. I think in general, people would agree everyone should have some kind of insurance coverage. And you talk about the Obama plan mandating contributions from employers. And my question gets to access, because the access crisis, I think, is real. And how, I mean, even if everybody gets some kind of universal coverage, when doctors can't afford to see those patients because the reimbursement from that coverage plan is so poor, there's an access problem. And so what is the senator's thoughts on this access crisis, and is that going to be mandated?
Well, this is a very, very important point that you're making. It's about access, and I want to make sure we're on the same page here when we talk about access. Some people, it's amazing, like if you go to Washington, even some very sophisticated health policy experts and legislators think that access is having an insurance card, and that health care is whatever you get. You go to an emergency room, that's health care. Most of us understand it very differently. It means insurance. It means appropriate benefits. It means actually having the right kind of doctor in the right place at the right time that's accessible to families. It means reimbursing the doctors well enough so they could actually deliver the care. It means a much broader understanding of what's involved than we typically see. What's been incredible is that, to me, in learning more and more about Barack Obama, is the depth of his understanding about exactly those points. He points out, you know, Massachusetts mandated universal coverage, right? So the waiting time to get a primary care appointment went from a few weeks to 11 weeks. Why? Because there's not enough primary care doctors, and there's not enough in the pipeline, and the reimbursements are not right yet. The thing about somebody like Barack Obama, this is what happens when you have insight and a lot of IQ points. You say, I get that, I understand that. His agenda is to work with physicians and physician groups to figure out those problems. What actually do you need to be reimbursed fairly so that you can continue to deliver those services? What are we going to do about the pipeline? How much more can we invest in the National Health Service Corps so that we get doctors going to medically underserved communities? How much more do we need to put into supporting doctors in private practice, but also maybe supporting the community health centers and so forth? This is a big picture view that encompasses all those things that you're talking about. And this is, to me, critically important that we have a leader, for once, at the top of the heap that gets those nuanced and critical issues that involve all of us who are trying to practice medicine.
Dr. Redliner, thank you very much for helping to explain Senator Obama's vision for us.
I appreciate it.
Thank you.
I had to keep you on schedule, sir.
Dr. Redliner mentioned an article or two that was published recently critiquing the plans, the McCain plan, the Obama plan. And just wanted to let you, and the Wall Street Journal covered it yesterday. Those papers were published on the website of Health Affairs 2 or 3 days ago. They're freely accessible on the website, which is www.healthaffairs.org. We asked analysts who would be critical of the McCain plan to write about it, and we asked their counterparts who would be critical of the Obama plan to write about it, and we asked Professor Mark Pauly at the Wharton School at Penn to write his vision of a compromise, taking the best elements from each plan and coming up with a different approach. So if you're interested in those papers, as I say, they're freely accessible on the website of Health Affairs.